content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. We're going to return to Carolina Critters, Animals and People in North Carolina History. It's the Fall 2024 edition, Volume 64, Number 1. And we'll begin with Critter Encounters. We who are part of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association like to say, history is all around us. Well, our history with animals is all around us, too. Sometimes we just need to look a little more closely to notice. Here are some photos from North Carolina history where animals were part of the story. What can you tell just by looking at them? Can you guess when the photos were taken? What questions do you have? Read the captions for details. How can you learn more? Now try this. Look through your own photos and the photos that document your family's special history. Can you find any animals? Hint, study the background as well as the main subject. Did you find more animals than you expected? What's going on in each photo? What did you learn? If you have questions, ask your family members to tell you the story. So the first photograph is Harold Lutz with his 4-H champion jersey at the 1938 State Fair. What do you and your family do when you're hungry? Go to the grocery store? Order takeout from a restaurant? In the past, many North Carolinians lived on small farms and produced much of their own food. They raised cows, chickens, and pigs for meat, milk, and eggs, and grew their own fruits and vegetables. Also associated with these comments is a photograph. NC State's Youth Market Turkey Show program gives 3 baby turkeys to kids ages 5 to 18 to raise at home. In October, students enter their best market turkey in the North Carolina State Fair Show. Here's another picture. Fishermen unload shrimp at Southport, circa 1945 to 1948. And next to it, 2 small boys show off their catch for the camera, circa 1929 to 1936. And the comments that come with that, fishing has always played an important role in North Carolina history. People fished for food, for fun, and for income. Today, our state boasts a multi-billion dollar fishing industry, but people still fish for recreation in our state parks, along rivers and lakes, and at the Carolina coast. Next, photographer Hugh Martin poses in front of the camera for a change with Mildred the Bear. In 1968, Hugh Martin brought 2-year-old Mildred the Bear from the Atlanta Zoo to North Carolina to breed in the wild with a male bear that had come with her. The male bear took off into the woods. But Mildred had been domesticated at the zoo, and she decided she'd rather hang out with the people. She became a beloved attraction at Grandfather Mountain, known for her friendly demeanor and playful antics, which endeared her to visitors. Here, there are some photographs courtesy of the State Archives of North Carolina. It says underneath the two of them, in 1970, Slowpoke the Possum won the prettiest possum competition at the annual Spivey's Corner Hollering Contest. The winner was given to Governor Bob Scott, who decided to make a meal of him. But hundreds of people wrote to the governor to protest. At last, Governor Scott pardoned Slowpoke in a ceremony at the state capitol, and that's the photograph on the left. And then on the right, eventually Slowpoke was set free at Raven Rock State Park. Next are a couple of images courtesy of North Carolina Museum of History. Madeline Glory Hancock of Asheville earned many decorations serving as a field nurse on the front lines in Europe during World War I. She was adventurous and an animal lover and adopted many unusual animals for pets. This image on the left of her riding a camel is from her scrapbook in the museum's collection. On the right, Flight Officer Russell M. Maugans, M-A-U-G-A-N-S, fought in Europe during World War II. He is pictured in England greeting his two dogs after flying a mission in his plane Carolina Chariot, circa 1941 to 1945. Next, some famous animals from North Carolina Zoo history. Downward dog? No, elephant leg lift. Have you ever seen an elephant do yoga? As of 2024, Caesar, C-apostrophe-S-A-R, is the oldest African bull elephant living at the North Carolina Zoo and one of the oldest in the United States. He came to the zoo in 1978 when he was just 4 years old. In 2019, zoo staff noticed that Caesar's sheer size, 12,000 pounds, was taking a toll on his body. So they started him on yoga to help with his range of motion. Next, slow and steady wins the race. Three visitors admired Tort, a Galapagos tortoise, in 1974. In 2024, the zoo installed bronze statues at the North American entrance to honor Tort and his companion Retort, who were the first two animals to arrive at the zoo 50 years ago. And we have one more North Carolina state animal to take a closer look at. The state marsupial is the Virginia opossum, which was named a state animal in 2013. The Virginia opossum, Didelphis virginiana, is a marsupial. The mothers carry their babies in a pouch after they are born. The Virginia opossum is the only marsupial native to North America. Most, like kangaroos, live in Australia. Some scientists call opossums living fossils because they have survived almost unchanged for 50 million years. They are nocturnal, that is, active mostly at night, and have the most teeth of any North American land mammal, 50 sharp teeth. Fun fact, when threatened, opossums can pretend to be dead. That's where we get the expression, playing possum. Next, the manner of their fishing. American Indians lived along the coast of what we now call North Carolina for thousands of years before the first Europeans arrived. The waterways were a source of life, and the native people used dugout canoes for fishing, hunting, and travel. We don't know how early American Indians might have depicted themselves, and there were no cameras to take photographs, but this watercolor called The Manner of Their Fishing, circa 1585 to 1593, was painted by English explorer John White to record what he observed. What do you think of how he painted the scenes? Can you find three methods of fishing shown in the painting? During the day, people fished with spears and nets. At night, they might build a small fire in their canoes to attract fish. Sometimes they would roast the fish over the fire. They also built weirs, W-E-I-R-S, fish traps or fences in the water made of sticks and reeds. The painting shows many animals, even though not all would have been seen at the same time or in shallow waters. What animals can you find? What else can you see and learn from the painting? Here's the caption that accompanies this article. Early American Indians crafted dugout canoes like the one in the painting above from a single tree. First, they burned a small area of the trunk to make the tree fall. Next, they hollowed out one long side of the log by burning and then scraping the wood with shells and other tools. Some canoes were deep for fishing. Others were shallow for fast travel. The canoe in this photo was on display at the North Carolina Museum of History. It is one of more than 30 canoes discovered between 1985 and 1989 at the bottom of Lake Phelps in present-day Terrell and Washington counties. Scientists estimate that this one was made around 900 BCE, almost 3,000 years ago. What's that? Chomp. This artifact is shaped like an alligator about to bite. It's very detailed and lifelike, but what is it? What is it used for? The alligator is roughly 9 inches long and about 3 inches wide. It appears to be made of metal, but what's that small textured pad on its back? What's that all about? What do you think this artifact is? It could be some kind of boot scraper to help a person clean their muddy shoes before coming inside. It could be a toy that a kid got as a souvenir on a trip to the Florida Everglades. A creepy decoration that a Victoria explorer displayed in his fancy parlor to scare little children. Or a pincushion used to hold pins for sewing clothes. It says to turn to page 24 to find out. On page 24, you'll find the answer is pincushion, from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. Today, most people don't use pincushions, but in the 1800s and 1900s, pincushions were everyday objects and were often decorative or funny. Pincushions held pins stuck into a tight, cushy area upright and at the ready for a sewer to grab so they could pin fabric in place until it was stitched. But why an alligator pincushion? Was this a gift for someone who loved reptiles? A souvenir from a trip to Florida? Your guess is as good as ours. Think about it. What if we had asked you about the animals in your life before you read this Carolina Critters issue of Tar Heel Jr. Historian Magazine? You might have said, oh, I have a cat, or a dog, or a hamster, or a horse. But what about now? Take a notebook with you over the next few days or weeks. Look for the animals that creep, crawl, hop, gallop, slither, or swim through your day. Write down your thoughts and observations. Here are some places to look: in your house, in your yard, or on your street. At school, in your classroom, or on the school grounds. How about in your textbooks or library books? On vacation, in the mountains, at the beach, or at a historic site. And at museums, in paintings, sculptures, exhibits, and other displays. Ask yourself, what do I see? What did I learn? What questions do I have? How is this animal a part of the story of North Carolina? Finally, for this edition, from the editor, What Do You Think? By Kathy East, who was the editor of this magazine. This has two photos with it. A North Carolina State student scoops strawberry howling cow ice cream at the North Carolina State Fair. And a student works with a young calf on the biomedical campus, VetMed, at NC State. At Tar Heel Jr. Historian Magazine, we like to look for new ways to explore our state's past. We love animals, and we figure you do too. So we decided to try the Carolina Critters theme as a fresh way to explore the history of North Carolina. What do you, now that you've read this issue, think about that? Did you learn something new? I did. I didn't know that the giant prehistoric megalodon shark left teeth on our Carolina beaches. Awesome! And I had fun reading the legend of how the opossum, our state marsupial, got that skinny, hairless tail. Here's another cool thing I've learned. The College of Veterinary Medicine at NC State University is one of the top vet schools in the nation. The school is famous for advancing animal and human health through innovative research and education. And it's one of the few vet schools in the United States that offer an on-site teaching unit that operates as a working farm. So students get real-world hands-on experience. Even cooler, Howling Cow Ice Cream. Developed in the 1940s, the ice cream started as a college cafeteria choice. Today you can find it at the State Fair and a few other locations. The ice cream is made from fresh milk and cream that comes directly from more than 300 cows on NC State's 329-acre dairy farm. The Howling Cow brand was officially established in 2008. Today, the brand focuses on educational outreach about dairy production through the Howling Cow Dairy Education Center and Creamery. See, history is all around us. So keep exploring our world with your historian's eye, and you'll learn new things about North Carolina's past, present, and future. On to the Spring 2025 edition, Volume 64, Number 2. And it's titled, Surprising Stories, How Primary Sources Bring History to Life. And we're going to start with a message from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Program Coordinator, Colleen McGilvray. A picture is worth a thousand words. I've heard this saying many times. Maybe you have heard this saying too. But I think this statement needs an upgrade because lots of things besides photographs can tell us stories about the past. We just need to look for the right items, primary sources, items created at the time of an event or by someone who was there that gave us firsthand information about the event. One of my favorite primary sources is a scrapbook that my grandmother, Paula McGilvray, created about her trip to Washington, D.C. in 1991. She traveled to see the White House holiday decorations made by needlepointers like her from across the country. A needlepoint ornament she created was one of many ornaments on display. She included photographs from the day, including one of her and a friend at the White House. Other treasures from the scrapbook include an event program and her entry ticket. The scrapbook is a primary source that tells a story about my grandma. Read more about primary sources in this issue and learn the stories that they can tell. There are three photographs accompanying this article. The first one's caption is, Grandma McGilvray made notes on needlepoint instructions that helped me find the needlepoint ornament she made. She made the ornament of three stars. My grandma McGilvray's scrapbook is one of my favorite primary sources. It's fun to learn about her trip to Washington, D.C. And Grandma McGilvray, on the left, and dressed in blue, traveled to Washington, D.C. with a friend. Here's a caption for the photograph on the cover. Homesick folks writing home during the Civil War left us with valuable primary sources to study so we can learn more about their lives. Martha Henley Poteet put a tracing of her four-week-old daughter's hand in a letter to her soldier husband and said, Write to me what to name her. This is from the private collections of the Poteet-Dixon letters. Next, the introduction to the magazine issue, Primary Sources, Why Do They Matter? By Chelsea E. Weger, who is Curator of Education Outreach at the North Carolina Museum of History. I love history. When I was a kid, I couldn't read enough historical fiction books. My favorite movies were set in the past. Every family vacation included stops at museums, historic sites, and battlefields. I appreciate that my parents fostered my interests because now I work at the North Carolina Museum of History, helping students like you to better understand and connect to social studies. One way I help students connect is by revealing that you really do like history, even if you don't know it yet. I think in today's time, it's easy to view people from the past as one-dimensional. When learning history, we're often presented with names and dates to memorize. We take a test, and then we move on to the next lesson. And sure, history is full of dates and facts, but what makes history come to life are the primary sources. It's through primary sources that we realize that those names and dates represent real people. They represent a person who lived, who had complex emotions, who experienced triumphs and tragedies. They made good decisions and mistakes. They had family and friends. Their choices made change. They mattered. As a student, you've probably heard a lot about primary sources. Which sources are actually primary? What sites are reliable? What's in a bibliography? Seriously, what's the big deal? Let's start by defining a primary source, which is an account, record, or object created that reflects a first-hand experience of an event or time. First-hand experience is a key phrase here. While some primary sources supply factual information about an event or subject, other primary sources provide the viewpoint of the person or people who experienced the event or subject. Both are equally important for historians as we try to piece together parts of the past. To recap, any image, film, sound recording, piece of writing, or human-made object can be a primary source. That includes pieces created digitally, too. Most primary sources fall into one of the following categories. 1. Artifacts. 2. Documents. 3. Images. 4. Oral histories. And 5. Buildings and sites. So first, artifacts. Artifacts are objects made and used by humans. They can be big like an airplane or small like a pair of shoes. Some, such as a pen used to sign the state constitution, relate to an event that affected many people. Others show how daily life has changed. Regardless of size, the core mission here at the North Carolina Museum of History is to collect and preserve artifacts related to the history and heritage of our state, a responsibility we embrace with pride and dedication. Documents. Documents include almost any kind of written or printed information. Letters, diaries, birth certificates, emails, maps, and census records are just a few examples. Personal documents offer windows into an individual's thoughts, feelings, and opinions presented in their own words. Remember, first-hand experience. However, it's important to remember that even first-hand accounts, while genuine reflections of that person's experience, may contain errors or lack broader context. For a current example, think about posts made on social media where people react to news stories that only contain part of a story. That person's thoughts and opinions are real, but their knowledge and understanding of an event may be incomplete. Public documents generally include official records like property sales, marriages, military service, or legislative votes. Comparing documents that are related to the same event or subject provide a variety of perspectives and help historians draw balanced conclusions that represent the complexities of that event or subject. Images. An image is a visual likeness of people or objects. Images can include painted portraits, sketches, engravings, and photographs. People have produced images for many reasons, like reporting news or capturing memories. You've probably snapped at least one photo on your phone just today, a digital primary source. While analyzing images, we discover how people dressed, worked, traveled, and played. We can also see how places change over time. Oral histories. Oral histories record people telling their own experiences and allow us to hear history directly from someone who was there. Oral histories can share an individual's recent memories or stories from events that they experienced long ago. Because we can hear and sometimes see the person sharing about the past, these recollections are unique. Oral histories can be gathered from anyone, including people who may not write or otherwise record their insights. Oral histories can also shed light on cultural traditions rarely recorded in official sources. Buildings and sites. Buildings are also primary sources. Have you ever passed a tobacco barn? Primary source. An old factory? Primary source. A lighthouse? Primary source. There are all kinds of buildings, from log cabins to high-rise apartments. They can be private or public. Some, like courthouses, town halls, and post offices, are used for government purposes. Others are used for religious worship, business, or recreation. Buildings show how people have adapted to their environment and can reflect an owner's wealth, a region's styles, or changes in technology. Sites tell us about the past, too. Cemeteries, American Indian mounds, battlefields, monuments, and abandoned roadways are all places filled with history to explore. So the big deal about primary sources? Learning to analyze sources and separate facts from fiction matters. Connecting to our shared history matters. Understanding our past to better shape our future matters. I hope this issue helps you as junior historians develop the tools you need to recognize and understand primary sources so you can dive deep into history, local, state, national, and international, and be empowered by the knowledge you gain. Here are the photographs accompanying that article. This photo was taken on the steps of a historic home in Arlington, Virginia, during a family vacation when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And fast forward to 2025, this photo was taken in front of the British Museum, on my last vacation in London, England. Some things never change. Here's a Think About It sidebar article. How to analyze a primary source. When analyzing a primary source, here are a few questions to help get you started. What is it? Think about the five categories we've identified. Who created it? When was it used and where? What ideas are expressed? How do you know? Why was the source created? For what audience? What did you notice first? How does it fit in with other sources? What did you notice that you didn't expect? What questions does the source raise? Also included in this article, as historians, we're not supposed to really have favorites, but I do. Here are a few of my favorite primary resources. Number one, Benjamin Franklin's Walking Stick. Number two, Glamorous Glennis. Number three, The Coronation Chair. Number four, North Carolina's copy of the U.S. Bill of Rights. And number five, Lucrezia de' Medici, born 1545 to 1561. I'll go over these in more detail next time. We'll also be including articles next time, what is a primary source and what is a secondary source? And New Roots Oral Histories, First-Hand Perspectives of North Carolinians with Latin American and Caribbean Heritage. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We're going to stand by.